Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Uli Korch. Ira is an independent trader and has been the director for CME from 1997 to 2003. He actively trades foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for the past 40 years. And Uli is the founder of both the Monetary Trust Initiative and Global Partners Investments. He has worked in over 50 countries, written a bill for Congress, and conferred with approximately 15 national presidents, ministers of finance, and ministers of commerce. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Great. I thought we'd have a focus today on Europe and to begin that discussion, what's happening in Switzerland. Ira, you've written recently about the Swiss Central Bank, the SNB, and how they are essentially creating a massive hedge fund and what they're doing in terms of the currency and purchasing of equities. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, and now we have Uli with us today, so yes. My point being that the Swiss print an awful lot of Swiss francs regularly as a means of intervening into the markets, and therefore when they print those Swiss francs, they sell them, and of course they exchange them for primarily euros and then some dollars, some yen, some Aussies, and they're busy accumulating a massive, and I would say massive is the right word, equity portfolio along with their foreign exchange reserves. So, you know, it's like, they hold $2 billion worth of Apple stock because that's what they're busy doing, because their policy of intervention, of course, is to try to keep the Swiss franc from appreciating too much. Of course, back in January 15th of 2015, they let the peg go, and we saw one giant move up in the Swiss, and the Euro Swiss, I think, on that day wound up going down to about 85 from what the previous floor that they were defending, of course, was 1.20. Presently, as I'm looking at my screen, we're 107.22. So, you know, the policy, it's been very steady for the moment with all this intervention. But the world sits back and allows the Swiss to actively be a currency intervener. But the Swiss are certainly smart enough to understand they don't want to just hold everybody else's currency. They are buying real assets through their process of intervention.
And as you mentioned, the Swiss franc represents the fragility of the global financial and political system, as investors are willing to buy Swiss assets with negative yields out to over 10 years. So it's quite impressive, shocking what's happening. And then you mentioned also there's a tie-in with potentially increasing its gold reserves. How would that work out?
Well, that's my response. I would say that if I was running the S&P, that as long, you know, if you're buying all those equity, you may as well start adding to your gold reserves, which is in contravention to what the Swiss had actually wanted to do, because there was a referendum, and Uli will tell me, I forget already whether it was 2 or 3 years ago, about actually, you know, selling off some of their gold, and the referendum failed. But with all this money printing or money creation, fiat currency creation around the world, because don't forget the Japanese are still actively involved. The ECB, even though this weekend they'll drop 25% from 80 billion in purchases a month to 60 billion, there's still a lot of currency creation. And we know that the Fed has yet to decide what they're going to do to shrink their balance sheet, whether they're going to let it do it organically or whether they're going to actually make some type of move to start shrinking it by selling off some of their assets. So presently, you know what, the gold does provide, as you know, a lot of people have been saying, oh, gold should be down at $800 or $900. But even with the Fed raising rates, like we saw them in March, my timeline's a little crazy. So we've seen two recent rate increases, and gold has done nothing but turn higher. There's, you know, and of course we know that gold is turning higher even as the ECB purchases. So I would, you know, it was somewhat tongue in cheek, but if I was running the S&P, part of my portfolio would certainly be added to my gold holdings.
And Uli, what do you think of this financial alchemy in terms of what's happening, basically converting cash into real assets of companies around the world?
As Ira just said, it's a heck of a lot better than holding somebody else's junk currency. I'm not even sure. I want to apologize for the word junk. the referendum, by the way, was November the 30th, 2016, and it was to increase their gold sales. Gold holdings. Not sales.
But 2 years ago, I thought they were going the other way, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, they are. No, they're selling, and the referendum was in order to try to stop the selling and have them continue to hold gold, and to repatriate the gold, because I think, you know, certainly with the Fed here, there's been a lot of question mark as to whether they actually hold the gold that they say they do. My understanding from multiple sources is that the amount of paper gold out there is approximately 100 times as much as the amount of real gold. So what the heck is really out there? I'm not sure anybody knows. The London, the turnover in London is, they've got 9,500 tons or something like that. It's in the 9,000 ton range. They sell that every day and a half. Really? I'm going, really? Are you serious? They sell more than all the known gold in the whole world, at least every year. I don't know how many months it is. The turnover is insane. In other words, how much of this is real and how much isn't? Anyway, that's a different discussion. I'm sorry. I think, you know, Switzerland as an island surrounded by the Eurozone, certainly for Europeans, although so much of our market, you know, is really global these days, but certainly for Europeans who tend to think a little bit more locally, it's an island of monetary stability. And so, as Ira just said, they're trying to weaken their currency through the sale, you know, through the quote printing or the increase in reserves and then the purchase of various assets. Let's switch to Europe proper. I believe it was today that the formal notice for Section 50 of the EU, the letter went from yes. Prime Minister May, right. In England out. I think that was today.
Yeah.
And so that formal process is going on. Italy is certainly in very bad shape. And I think if they were to use, gap accounting for their banks, I think the country would instantly go bankrupt. And France isn't that much further behind. And of course, we know where Greece is. So this back to Switzerland, this island of stability until these kinds of actions. So if the Swiss National Bank were to lose a ton of money on their assets, which I think they will, the situation is a little different in Switzerland than it is, say, for the Fed, because the Swiss National Bank, I believe about 45% is actually owned by private individuals, which is very different. So the structure of the Swiss, Ira, you probably know that, right? Well, what's the percentage?
I think it's maybe higher than that. I actually tried to buy some stock about 30 years ago. I was rebuffed.
Okay.
Because I said, wow.
Really?
That's,
wow.
You know, the bank is a The Bank of Japan is similarly held too. You know, there's a big private holding for the BOJ that people forget about. So there is a lot of risk involved in that. But yeah, it's a very good point, though.
Yeah, the Fed, for instance, you know, it's a totally different story that they're owned by their member banks. It's impossible to go bankrupt. I mean, the Fed can have a negative equity and who the heck cares? Whereas if you have that for the Swiss National Bank, that's a different story. I think you'd have one heck of a lot of screaming. And with the assets that they're purchasing in all the other currencies, or certainly in, you know, globally around the world, because that's the whole point, is to weaken their currency. When these stocks or bonds or their various holdings tank, which I think we are coming up to a recession. I think it's going to be very global. Our debt levels are again greater than they were in 2007 before the last recession. And this time, we do not have the fallback positions of the emerging markets, which we had then. So plus the political problems, you know, even though things in Holland turned out okay in the election that just occurred. And certainly all the odds are that Marine Le Pen will not win the second round. You know, mind you, everybody said Trump wasn't going to either. But certainly the shaking that is occurring is very substantial. And when the debt levels again get to the point where we have another recession, what is going to be the fallback this time, other than more debt? You know, it's the old, you know, alcoholic. He wakes up with a hangover. Well, the way to solve the problem is you give him more alcohol. That's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting that you say that, you, because, you know, as Richard and I talked months ago, last June, right after the Brexit vote, Jerome Powell was in Chicago giving a speech, you know, about the Fed, and it was 2 or 3 days after Brexit. And then so I had the ability to ask the question to him directly about, because, you know, with the building up of the ECB balance sheet, which certainly ties into the strength of the Swiss, because as you say, Europeans are still parking money in Switzerland, and you'd go, well, that's insanity, because it's negative interest rates. The currency holds, so I certainly understand that. But from any other type of rational viewpoint, why would you be buying the Swiss franc? And, of course, it's a comment about Europe. But I asked Jerome Powell directly. I said, well, you're not just a Fed, you're an FOMC governor. How do you view the concept of the ECB, and who guarantees that balance sheet? And he, without missing a beat, said to me, they have a printing press. I mean, you know, that'd be okay for somebody on television who is an economist to say, but for a Fed governor, I was kind of taken aback by that, because it was such, he didn't even think about it. He just said, well, they have a printing press. So that sticks in my mind, because that seems to be the operative mindset of how to deal with what you brought to the fore, which is the pending debt situation. And if we do go into that global recession, the overhang of debt is greater than it was in 2007, 2008.
Right, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And we need to understand, I mean, one of the arguments that we get against the evil of the debt, if I may use that, is, well, it's owed to somebody. But actually, no, it's not. It's not owed to anybody. It's created by the banks, because almost all of our money today is electronic. You know, it's in the 95%+. And right. So, no, it's not owed to anybody. It's not like my savings are your debt. That wouldn't be all that bad then, because the two would neutralize each other. But they don't, because the money is created by the banks through debt. So it's a cockeyed situation. I mean, it's genuinely frightening.
I know. You know, when I talk about gold, people say, oh, you're a gold bug. I said, not whatsoever. But I'm a realist, because I'm looking on the same horizon you are and going, where does this end? I mean, I know that history is replete with the stories. You know, we can go back to, 1500s, 1600s, 1400s in Europe. We can go, of course, back earlier. But when nations inflated their way out, you know, whether they clipped coins or whatever way you wanted to go about it. It was still inflating away the debt. The scenario doesn't change. It doesn't really change. And I go, people are so, they're asleep here. It's like, you want to, you know, I can justify buying a Bund. Well, I can't. I can't buy a two-year German note at negative 80 and justify it with German inflation running 1.7%. I can't. Right. I can't even get any currency appreciation. So what's my incentive? No. So without the ECB, but it's still, and yet they're the best credit probably next to Switzerland. Switzerland is certainly the most high quality credit, but Germany after that is probably the second best credit right now in the world because they stand on the pillar of, they've got a huge current account surplus. Of course, you know, they're being attacked for it. They run a budget surplus. I would make them a very strong credit, but wow, the world has been really, the central banks have turned the world upside down, and we're not even close to understanding what right side up is.
No, that's very true. It's very, very true.
So how sustainable is this, what's happening in Europe or in Switzerland? Like, at what point could it break down, and, you know, what are those factors that could contribute to that?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is obviously the most, you know, one of the most famous quotes by Keynes, which I always get wrong, but it's something like the market can be irrational a lot longer than you can be liquid, you know.
Yeah.
let me help you. The quote I believe is attributed is more than you and I can remain solvent.
Yeah, right. There we right. go. Yeah. That's right.
One of my favorites also.
Yeah, sad to say, it's very true. I think the question comes down to Richard. In my mind, we've already had—is it the longest or the second? Certainly, at least the second longest running time between recessions since World War II. And the question in my mind is: will the next recession be deep enough that some of these abnormal situations, extraordinary situations,
right, distortions
or actions, yep, will they then fall apart, or will it take another recession past that? Because we have both political and market pressures, and then if you talk China and Russia, we have military pressures. And you know, I don't know if you saw, so the Russians are going to have the largest Eastern European military exercise, and I don't know how long, this September, where over 100,000 Russian soldiers are going to be participating, and they're really worried about it, saying this is power play versus all the small nations that are immediately ringing around there. And then, you know, obviously the lies, if I may say so, that Xi told us that they're not going to militarize the islands in the South China Sea. Well, they are. Now they're finally saying, well, the reason we did that is in order to make sure that the shipping lanes remain safe. Well, they've remained safe since World War II. There hasn't been a problem. And you quote Mr. Xi, promised unconditionally that you would not do that. So we have three aspects. We have a very unbalanced market. We have, especially in Europe, a very fragile political situation. And now, over the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years, it's very recent, we now have also military aspects, and then you know, I can include Trump in that, where he's a really unknown quantity when it comes to what he would do under a real pressure. Aren't I just a wonderful optimist?
Yeah. Okay. And your thoughts, Ira, on the sustainability?
You know, I unfortunately have never read Uli's work, but I'm going to get fine. The Monetary Trust Initiative, I've written it down because we're simpatico on so many issues. And one of the things that, you know, Richard, you and I have talked about, one of the things that Trump has actually, I think, had right is the role of NATO in the world. Because, you know, and everybody says, oh, you know, Trump says NATO. First of all, NATO is, it served its purpose for a long time, but it's just because we get into this mindset, you don't have to see it to its illogical end. And I think that Trump is right in wanting to roll back, quote unquote, Pax Americana. You know, it's served its time, and you don't have to serve out your imperial desires until you go broke like Britain, you know, and having basically to capitulate in Suez in 1956. You do not have to end that. You can control some of these events through better decision-making. You know, people can get up in arms about NATO, but I'll always ask the question. You know, these are the same people who got up in arms when Trump called into question the one China. Right? And I think he was totally wrong for doing it, but the one China policy came into existence under, you know, with Nixon, certainly. Well, everybody had agreed anyway, but when Nixon went to China in 71 or 72, was the United States going to risk thermonuclear war to save the independence of Taiwan? Well, no. I think so. Then you adhere to a one China policy. So I would ask the same question. If Turkey and Russia were to wind up in a war, which is not without question, by the way, there's enough uncertainty in that whole area where that funny things could happen. Yeah. And Article 5 of NATO were to be invoked, would the United States risk thermonuclear war to save Turkey in today's world? Because Turkey's strategic value is far different than it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, the world is changing dramatically, and Trump isn't wrong to address these. Certainly may not agree with some of the ways he wants to, but with the rollback of Pax Americana, the Chinese go, hey, there's opportunity for us to stretch our legs, so to speak. And Putin is certainly going to keep pushing against the United States because he detested, and I'm certainly not going to be, Putin doesn't need me to defend anything that he wants to do, but there was a question of what agreements were made on the unification of Germany. You know, Putin and even, Gorbachev even says that there were agreements made with James Baker, and I have a lot of respect for James Baker, but he's been awfully quiet about the whole Ukrainian situation, that they would not go beyond what was the borders of East Germany. Well, we know that that has been violated time and time again. And we certainly know that what took place in the Ukraine, you know, that NATO and Western Europe may have stretched themselves. And of course, with Victoria Nuland and her comments and her actual aiding of the Ukrainian movement against Russia, certainly was aided in that regard. So there's things afoot here. And Putin is trying to, of course, express his discontent. And he's challenged, you know, Merkel, you know, who knows what really was discussed between Merkel and Trump and the way that they see this whole thing. But I think Putin is going to keep pushing, you know, Europe talks, oh, yeah, we'll meet our budget numbers of 2% for NATO or for defense spending. But Putin is going to test them and find out how serious they are. You know, right now, NATO, is a joke anyway, because during Libya, the French and British and Italian Air Force had to borrow ordnance from the United States. They couldn't supply enough weaponry. So, you know, let's be serious. There's definitely the world is in flux. And I think Uli's point is certainly well taken, is that based on the political uncertainty that exists, markets are not pricing it in. And that's, to me, where the real risk factors in this market lie.
Yeah. I agree. Do you remember before World War One? It could have been World War Two also. If you look at the bond prices, which one would think would factor in these kind of geopolitical risk factors that we're talking about right now, there was zero price factoring until all hell broke loose. Very interesting.
Yeah. I do. You know what? I remember reading that fact in, I think it was Niall Ferguson's book on World War One, which was really a great study. Even in two or three days afterwards, they were still bidding bonds. You know, it's preposterous.
Okay. Wow. I mean, if we look at two potential big events in Europe, in the Eurozone, that could happen, that could have potential major implications for the global economy and the financial markets. Just wondering your assessment of the probability of these two events happening. That the first would be if any major country exits the Eurozone, possibly lesser ones, but would likely see a cascade of defaults, you know, unprecedented, right, in the history of the global economy. And another one would be, the other event would be the potential for the ECB to guarantee at that point, you know, basically printing enough euros to cover the losses. So, I mean, you know, the probability of these two events happening, not happening, any ideas on that? Maybe start with Uli first.
I would say the second of the ECB then doing a full guarantee is virtually zero unless because of Germany which would stop that unless there was a split in the Eurozone basically between the North and the South where the EZ would then become Germany, Holland, France. I mean, those three for sure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, so and the probability of a Eurozone leaving, that was your first question, right?
Yeah, the first event. Yeah.
I would say it's 70%. I don't know. Ira, it'd be interesting to see what you say.
Well, it's which brings us to a question, Richard, you had around the edges about Britain today putting forth Article 50.
Yeah.
Let me backtrack in how I would answer this question because I agree with you. It all depends what the structure of this would be. But it's first of all, I don't think that Britain is going to, even though they're invoking Article 50, it's a two-year process now, right? Well,
yes.
So much could happen in the next 2 years in Europe. You know, that's why I listen to these people with their static analysis, and it bothers me because it's just so bad. There's so many moving parts to this. But Italy is in severe trouble. Severe trouble. And the fact that they can borrow money at these preposterously low rates, it's only, of course, because the ECB is in there. And Draghi knows it, and everybody else knows it. But the faster, which is why he's in a hurry to build the ECB balance sheet, because to me, the way that I see that balance sheet is it's a backdoor effort to create a European bond. And of course,
yes.
I mean, he goes to those G30 meetings, and he sits and he talks to the likes of Soros, who you know Soros is on the record. That if there was a European bond, a lot of this stuff would be moot points because there'd have to be a guarantor. Well, of course, we know the only ones who could guarantee that are the Germans. Because I certainly wouldn't take a Spanish guarantee. I wouldn't take an Italian guarantee. I wouldn't take there just wouldn't. So the Brits are going to get a two-year window here on a lot of things that could go topsy-turvy. And don't forget, if there's one thread of it, they will come begging the Britons back to come back in because they'll need them. And the Brits would then be able to make the greatest deal ever, which they'll be able to get back their sovereignty for financial assurances. That's what really bothers the Brits is they understand that the European Court of Justice, as my dear friend Bernard Connolly would say, is neither a court nor either judicious. It's a political entity that will support the EU effort at all costs. There's no laws. He likes to quote, I forget what it was, Gulati, who said, for our friends, for our enemies, we invoke the law, and for our friends, we interpret it. And that's what seems to play out in Europe regularly. So there's a lot that could go on here. But I think that the odds of Marine Le Pen actually winning are low. But of course, we've seen Trump and we've seen Brexit on some people's measures. But the system, the political system in France is so weighted against somebody like Le Pen. Because look, we saw it before. Sarkozy lost in the first round in 2012. And even the good conservatives found a way to vote for a socialist. So it makes Marine Le Pen's task very great. So let's say we get by that. Then the issue becomes Germany, because the German elections, and I know Merkel is now again on the up, but that's very careful, because, you know, we have voices, you know, not just Jens Wiedmann, but of course Otmar Issing, people who are really calling into question this whole, and dare I use the phrase, the financial repression of German savers. You know, everybody thinks this is only about immigration. It's not about it. The average German citizen is getting killed right now. Killed. Because we know, and you know as far better than I do, that Germans are not used to borrowing to finance asset purchases. It's just not in their fabric of the way that they look at things. But when you're running negative interest, real interest rates in Germany of what? And I'm going to be kind here of what? Negative 2.2, 2.3, 2.4 on, you know, short-term money. The real yields are negative yields. You've got to protect yourself. Otherwise, it's the ultimate piece of financial repression in order to bail out the rest of Europe. And I think that's what this election in Germany may hinge on. So that becomes more interesting even than the French election to me. But that's a ways away. The market has no way to take that in. But I think if we do lose, or if it breaks up north, south, and does the north take the euro, then we know that the euro and the Swiss National Bank will make a fortune because they've owned so many euros. So if they were voting, I'm sure that's the way that they would vote. If the southern nations wind up with the euro and everybody else goes recreate a synthetic Deutschmark, which I always give you this, which on the old measure, the Deutschmark right now would be trading 1.81. I would venture to say that if there was a return to some type of Deutschmark, we'd probably see it at around 1.20, 1.25. It entered the European Union at 1.67. So, you know what? That would be the most interesting outcome of all. So it was one of my favorite investments right now that I keep talking to people about is buying property in Germany.
I mean, a lot of scenarios out there, but like, given all of the factors and the probabilities, how do you see it actually playing out over the next, say, 6 to 12 months, the economic situation and implications, effects on financial markets, you know, from Europe and extending to the rest of the world? Uli? The most likely scenario from your assessment.
Let's say by the end of the year, I would say we have a 30-40% probability that there is going to be a serious crash.
Really?
By the end of this year, yeah. I think so. The problem is we're all on a tipping point. And the picture that I always use is the system is kind of like a plateau. So you've got, sort of very steep walls on both sides. And 20 years ago, the plateau was very wide. And the plateau has become narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower. And now it's like a mountaintop. And, What would get us to fall off the edge of the cliff? I have no idea. All I know is that the plateau has become more and more narrow. And so therefore, the initiating action it becomes more and more likely because it doesn't take very much to move us off one of these points.
Yeah, Ira, so, any thoughts on that? Yeah, how do you see it playing out?
No,
yeah.
That's an interesting, and we covered himself because I was going to ask, what do you think will be the, as I would say, the spark that ignites that situation in that time period? I'm not disagreeing because, the way that I've been trained and the way that I look through the world outside of a Marxist lens is an Austrian lens. And as Uwe rightfully talked about before, was the huge amount of debt that, you know, plagues the global system. And it does plague the global system, which is, you know, Richard, we go back, which is why I found the discussion about the border adjustment tax to be absolutely crazy. You know, Peter Buchfire and I, when we were on with you, we talked about that.
Yeah.
And because if you had a 20% appreciation of the dollar, the world would, that to me would be the spark that would create the situation that Uwe talks about. To me, unquestioned, because the huge amount of debt is dollar finance.
And you got 10 trillion worth of U.S. dollar denominated debt in non-U.S. dollar environments.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It makes the subprime situation ridiculous. And so when, you know, Peter and I talked about it, when Peter Buchfire and their models did not take that into consideration, well, you know, I go, well, that's a pretty important assumption to leave out as part of the legwork. And again, you know, part of the, you know, Giscard d'Estaing talked about that exorbitant privilege of the dollar. Well, there's a burden to it. And that said, you have to keep running these deficits at least until the world can find an alternative to financing the global expansion. So,
yeah, I don't understand why the Trump people don't understand that. Like, where do they think the world is going to get their dollars from if we do not run a deficit? I don't understand this. Like, hello? Anyway, sorry. I totally agree with you, Ira. Yes, absolutely.
So following Richard, following Uwe, Richard, I would just say that if you got that border adjustment tax, that would be the spark that would really ignite a terrible, terrible situation. And it's amazing, but we'll go back to Uwe's point about, you know, World War One with the bond market not being totally oblivious. That's how I see global equity markets. I mean, they're living on a hope and a dream. And they keep talking about tax cuts, but when I listen to the Trump people, they're talking tax reform, not necessarily tax cuts. And that's a far different thing.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Yeah, they're still talking revenue neutral.
Right. And if it's revenue neutral, there's going to be winners, there's going to be losers. If there's really good winners, it'll be the middle class, which has been so badly. You know, listen, that's why Trump won. That's why in Britain, they're not stupid.
Yes.
The people understood the financial obligations. And I'm willing to make anybody a wager that, you know, they're talking about the cost. And I know the Germans have been talking about it too. The cost of Britain leaving, that you're going to have to pay that bill of $62
billion. Yeah.
That's a nice soundbite. There'll be no cost whatsoever. Because how are you going to force the Brits to pay? You've already threatened them with everything anyway. We're leaving. You're not going to be able to trade. Well, the Brits are going to say, well, okay, if you're only going to punish me, well, what do you think, I'm stupid? Why am I going to pay you? There'll be no settlement of that debt ever. That much I'm pretty sure. In fact, I'm more than pretty sure. I will bet that's something I'm willing to wager on. So I'll have to call Ladbrokes and see if I get a price on that.
Wow, great insight, fascinating discussion. We're coming to the end of our time, but how can our listeners learn more about your work, Uli?
Probably the easiest, go to ulikorch.com. As usual, it's outdated. A bunch of papers I've written lately, they're not on there, and same with the videos. I've done another couple of videos, and none of them are online. I need to find out what's happening with my video guy.
Okay. Okay.
They're at least a month behind, so that's kind of gets to be frustrating. So,
great. And Ira?
Well, you know, if you go to iraharris.com and then click on Notes from Underground, that's my blog. But, you know, when Santelli comes back from vacation, I hope to be doing some very relevant hits with him because we've been covering the ECB for a long time. And of course, I would beg all the listeners again to go to rottenheartofeurope.com to purchase Bernard Connolly's book for $10, the best $10 anybody will ever spend. so that you really understand what's taking place in Europe and the different permutations of where we could go here, because this is not going to be a smooth slog. And now I will be going to Uli's site and catching up, because I have to say I've not read his things, but I will become an avid reader, Uli. I appreciate the time having spent with you here.
Well, thank you. It's mutual. I'm definitely going to be on IraHarris.com, but it'll probably be a week because I'm off to a conference early tomorrow morning, and I'm going to be going morning, noon, and night until Tuesday. So.
Okay, great. I hope it's a Fed conference and you beat some people up because they need a really good slap in their head.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll talk another time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard. All the very best.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.